I'd like to thank Professor Hublin for the invitation to be here. I really appreciate it. And I'm going to start with this picture of my son, Leo. He's about 9 months old here, and he's doing something that's very unusual for a mammal. Okay, what he's doing is he's eating food that is something other than breast milk, right? But he's at an age where he could not go find food himself. He can't feed himself. And this is something that we uniquely do. Okay, we provide these special weaning foods. And as we've already heard, this allows us to wean our children younger than other great apes. And the benefits to that have already been alluded to. It allows us to have a higher fertility rate, because once you wean, you can start having the next pregnancy earlier, right, and have more children. And this is one reason that there are more humans than there are chimpanzees in the world, right? We have much higher fertility. But you'll notice that there are other aspects of our life history that are different in this figure. This long blue line here, you see that adulthood starts later, so we begin reproducing at an older age. And as part of that stretching out of the pre-adult period, we have this period of very, very slow growth. Okay, our growth is extremely slow. We have less of a good explanation as to what is going on here. And so let's take a look at just how slow our growth is. I'm going to give you a feel for just how unusual we are as a species. What this shows is the energy expenditure of an organism, okay, different species, metabolic rate, versus their body mass. And these are both log-log plots, right? So each scale is in a log units. And you see there's this nice mathematical regularity here. And humans, in fact, are right on it, okay? The key thing to point out is that, of course, as you go from mice to elephants, the amount of calories that are expended go up. But the scaling coefficient here is less than one. And what that means is that calorie expenditure is increasing at a slower pace. So each kilogram of elephant uses less energy than a kilogram of mouse, if there was such a thing as a kilogram of mouse. And so when you look at other expenditures, like here, we have growth rate. You see that it has that same scaling coefficient, right? So that same constraint is there. And these dots up here, this is mouse, rats, guinea pigs, and sheep. They're right on the line. Okay, they're right on the mammal line, as you would expect. It's also makes good sense that the reptile line is down below that, right? Because they're cold-blooded, and so they're expending fewer calories and growing slower. What's odd is where we are as a species. We're actually on that reptile line rather than on the mammal line. And if we focus in here, okay, on mammals and reptiles of our size, let's take a look at their growth rates to give you a feel for how unusual we are. So these are mammals of about our size. And you can see that typical mammals are going to grow 50 to 100 times almost faster than we do. Right? We are growing at this incredibly slow pace. And when you compare us to reptiles, we're growing at about the pace of a python, okay, a snake. So humans grow at the pace of a reptile during childhood. Why is this? Now, we've already got some hints into this question, I think, from the past few talks. One hypothesis that's been cited is that our brains are so costly to develop, okay, energetically, that we've needed to divert some of those resources away from growth in favor of subsidizing the brain. And this is an idea that's been proposed by many through the years. And this is the question that I'm going to address today in my talk. Okay, we're going to talk about just how costly human brain development actually is. We're going to test this hypothesis that there's been a trade-off between the brain and body growth. And then we're going to look at some of the implications of this finding for hominin evolution in the study of our past. Okay, so what this shows here is resting metabolic rate. So this is your calories that your body is expending at rest, and the percentage of that going to the brain. And so all of you as adults right now, about 20% of your body's energy is going to your brains. And that's what this chart right here is showing. And you can see that these other species are more like 3 to 5%, right? So that's more typical. So we're expending a lot of energy on our brains. And of course, that's the adult level. But when you look at newborns, their brains are much larger relative to their bodies. And so you would expect this fraction to be much higher early in life. And the old estimates from the literature that I was able to find 20 years ago put that figure at 60%. So what this would suggest is that a newborn, 6 out of 10 calories that are being expended when they're at rest, when they're sleeping, are going just to keep their brain going. Now, given how expensive our brains are, as Carl has already emphasized, this idea that there might be a trade-off between the brain and growth, there might be something to this. It seems potentially sensible. Now, what we could do is we could devise a more refined hypothesis than this. If our brains, if this idea is correct and there's a trade-off, we would expect that our that the ages of slowest body growth, okay, when our growth is slowest, will also be the ages of highest brain energy needs. There'd be a trade-off between the two. Now, how would we compare this? We can use this same measure that I just showed, the percentage of resting metabolic rate to the brain. We can look at how that varies by age and see if that relates to growth rate. The problem, however, is that traditionally we've known very little about developmental changes in brain energetics and how costly the brain is. And so we've already got a hint as to how we might go about this. We see that the brain is much larger early in life than later. And in fact, it accounts for between 10 and 15% roughly at birth, okay, of body weight. And then that ratio gradually declines down to about 2 to 3%. Right, so we would expect that the brain is going to be a much bigger part of the energy budget early, and it's going to gradually decline. So this is part of this story. The other piece is reflected here in these data, and what this shows are our data on glucose uptake by the brain using positron emission tomography or PET imaging. And the brightness of the tissue tells you how much glucose is being taken up by a gram of tissue, right? So this is a per weight measure. And very clearly, the brain is at its brightest in this picture during childhood. This tells us that each gram of brain is most costly during childhood. And so we have to take both of these factors into account. How big is the brain, and how much energy is each unit of brain using? We have to look at that across the life cycle. And so, yeah, and first, here are those actual data on PET intake. So here, this dotted line is the adult level of glucose uptake. And you can see that at birth, each gram of cortical tissue is using less glucose than the adult brain, but this rises very rapidly to about twice the adult level during childhood, right? So we have to factor all this in, and when we do, okay, we can start with the size of the brain, and we're gonna use MRI-based measures of brain volume, so this is brain scans that tell you the volume of different regions of the brain, and then we multiply those volumes by the glucose uptake rate, okay, which is what I just showed you. And then those two things together are going to give us total brain energy costs, right? And then we do that across ages, and this is going to allow us to address our questions. And when we do that, this is what we find. Glucose is maxing out the brain's glucose use at about 5 years of age in both males and females. And you'll see that female glucose use is lower. That's because their brains and bodies are smaller. That's all that is indicating. But the amazing thing here, you see this dotted line, that's the adult level. The five-year-old's brain is using about twice the glucose of the adult. This is remarkable because the five-year-old's body is about one-third the size of the adult's body, right? So as a burden on the body and its energy budget, this is a very big drain. And so the next thing that we can look at here is go beyond just looking at glucose use and calculate this measure of percentage, you know, percentage of the body's energy budget going to the brain. And when we do that, this is what it looks like. So this is showing, again, percentage of resting metabolic rate going to the brain. It's peaking out between 4 and 5 years of age. And it's at that point that the brain accounts for two-thirds of all calories at rest, about 66%. Okay. So interestingly, the brain is actually not at its most costly right at birth when it's largest relative to the body. It's costliest here in mid-childhood. And I should emphasize, and when I showed you those data on glucose uptake, that peak in glucose uptake during childhood, what that reflects is the number of neuronal connections or synapses. Okay, so the density of synapses is increasing, and it's that cost of learning, okay, that really is pushing up the cost of the brain at this age. All right, now we can go one step, you know, at this point, we can begin to address our question. Are ages of high brain energy use also ages of slow weight gain and vice versa? And the answer is yes. Let's take a look at this. All right, so here we have weight gain. Okay, this is body growth rate in you know, kilograms, except I've converted this to SD scores, standard deviation scores, so that they're unitless, so we can compare it to brain glucose use. And you see that growth rate starts fast, it slows down, reaches a low point here, and then you get the pubertal growth spurt out here. If we map on the glucose data that I just showed you, clearly there's a correspondence between these. The age of peak glucose is also the age of lowest weight gain. Now, we can be more scientific about this and plot one of these. Instead of plotting them against age, let's plot weight velocity or growth rate versus brain energetics and see if those two things are related. When we do that, this is what the data look like. Now, if this was a perfect inverse relationship, that dotted line is what it would look like. So it's very close to that, right? So what we have down here is how costly the brain is on this axis and how fast growth is up here. And as you go from 1 to 2 years of age, what's happening is the brain is becoming increasingly costly, right? Because brain growth is continuing and the number of synapses is also increasing. So we're increasing in energy costs. And at that same time, body growth rate is decreasing, right? And the key thing to point out is that the difference here is about 1 standard deviation unit on this axis and about 1 standard deviation unit on this axis. So they're proportionate, which is where you get this nice linearity. Down here, between age 4 and 5, what's happening? Well, this is the age at which the brain is at its maximum, right? In terms of energetics, it's most costly. And weight gain is at its lowest. So this is the point at which the brain curve is up here, and the weight curve is corresponding to that. Once you get on the other side of that, and you start looking at 7-year-olds moving to 8, 78-year-olds, the brain is now becoming less costly because you have a process of synaptic pruning. So the number of those neuronal connections is being reduced. The brain is becoming less costly, and growth rate is correspondingly increasing, right? So there's, I think, very strong evidence here that there's been a coevolution between the cost of the brain and growth rate in our species. Now, here's an independent confirmation of this. This is a study that was not designed to test these evolutionary hypotheses, but that I think are very relevant to the question. What this shows is blood flow to the brain as a fraction of the total amount of blood flow out of the heart. All right, so this is kind of telling us, it's very similar to the question of the amount of resting metabolic rate to the brain compared to the body as a whole. This is saying what fraction of the body's circulation is going to the brain. And you can see, as with our data, it's peaking out at about 3 to 5 years of age, and then it gradually declines to a very similar level, as you know, to an adult level gradually. So I think this, I'm actually getting access to these data. These are folks at Northwestern, my university, who are doing this, and hope to do some additional analyses with these that replicate our findings. Okay, so let's discuss what all of this means for a few points here. So we started off talking about how it's clear why we wean early. The advantage to that is pretty clear. The explanations for child growth have traditionally been less clear. But I think our findings pretty clearly suggest that the slow pace of human child growth reflects a trade-off with the unusually high energy needs of human brain development. And I would emphasize that the hypothesis isn't that growth is entirely accounting for the cost of the brain, but there are likely to be trade-offs with other energetic expenditures at the same age. So maybe immune function or physical activity or others might also be reduced at this age. Okay, so we've talked about slow growth rate. Well, one of the implications of this is that we are deferring more of our growth to puberty, right? Now, many species have a pubertal growth spurt, but we have a particularly pronounced one. And so we're reducing our growth costs when the brain is very expensive, and as a result, we have to grow more out here. So I think our findings not only explain our slow childhood growth, but also why we have such a pronounced pubertal growth spurt. All right, so a couple questions then, and this is gonna maybe dovetail a little bit with some of what Carl talked about. Who pays for the expense of brain development of human children? And traditionally, ideas amongst evolutionary biologists and anthropologists or that the mother paid for it, either in utero or through breast milk, pays for brain development. But if you look at our data, it's pretty clear that in most human societies, weaning has already happened before this energy peak, so someone else is paying for it. And a similar and related question is, what about buffering? As Carl mentioned, the brain has a very constant metabolic rate, so you can't really turn it down during starvation, and so you have to have reserves of some sort. So what about body fat as a potential resource for that? Well, if you look at body fat, it's actually at its lowest at about the same age as brain energetics are at their peak. Now, this leads to, I think, a bit of a paradox. And you can think of this, I think, something that illustrates this is the concept of a mortgage or you know, the rent that you pay on your apartment. A mortgage or rent you have to pay every month or you get kicked out of your apartment, right? And so the bigger your mortgage, the bigger the savings account you have in case you lose your job and can't pay it, right? And so we have a situation here where our mortgage is at its peak, right? This non-negotiable part of our expenditure is at its lifetime peak at exactly the point when we have minimum savings, right? So how do we do this? This is a very risky strategy. And I think some of the work that Carl has done is in agreement with this. Our findings point to the importance of social buffering as a likely prerequisite to human encephalization. And this I mean allocare and provisioning by kin and non-kin, which we've already heard about, and also cooperation and food sharing. So let's take a very quick look at what I mean by all this. In your typical mammal, the mother is the sole source of energy for the child. In humans, the father is a part of that network, but then, of course, there are all these other allocare givers as well. The important point is that we have redundancy in who can provide energy, and each of those caregivers, in turn, is embedded within networks based upon cooperation and food sharing. So this food sharing and cooperation becomes very important, and here's why. Okay. What this shows is variability day to day in foraging returns. And so the higher this is, the more variability there is. So it's sort of feast and famine day to day. The more individuals that you share with, that variability goes down, right? So there's a buffering that happens socially. And this is exactly what human foragers do. So this shows data from lowland Amazon, from the Hiwi and the Aceh, showing this food sharing is, you know, exactly as predicted. And so sharing of food in human societies buffers individuals from hunger and starvation, including our energetically dependent children. So we are able to go out on this very risky strategy of having this very high mortgage, if you will, this very high non-negotiable brain requirement at an age when there's minimal savings because we have such good social buffering to back it up. Okay, so let's take a look then for this last question of what all this means for paleoanthropology. And if we could somehow, in the fossil evidence, identify and show that this very high brain energetics peak is there during childhood, I think we could infer the suite of other modern human life history traits were likely also present. Brain development. We would know that there was this prolonged, very energy-intensive pattern of childhood learning that is so characteristic of our species. That peak in brain energetics during childhood is when executive functions are developing, these higher cognitive abilities that really define our species. Trade-offs. We would know, as I've shown, that it was likely a very slow growth rate, that there would be a delayed and pronounced pubertal growth spurt. And then finally, we can infer that there had to be a support network socially to buoy and support that very expensive pattern of brain development. So how might we study this and reconstruct developmental brain energetics in the fossil record? Traditionally, cranial capacity, or the size of the skull from fossil specimens, has often been used to infer the brain's energy costs. But the problem is that our analysis shows pretty clearly that you cannot infer the brain's energy cost from its size. And this graph here shows this. What this shows is the amount of glucose that each gram of brain is using at birth and up to 5 years of age. And you can see that it's increasing by a factor of 2.5. So that is completely independent of size. That's each gram of brain. So clearly, cranial capacities only get us so far, and they kind of break down during development as a way to address this question. Now, luckily, there's a new approach, I think, that could start to move towards an answer to this, and that is looking at blood flow. Okay, the blood flow to the brain is strongly correlated with the brain's energy use, and flow to the brain actually can be estimated from skeletal samples. You see these little openings here that carry the arteries to the brain called foramina, and the size of those, as Seymour et al. And others have shown recently, is very strongly correlated with blood flow, and so this is one way to get at this question. And one group that has been refining these ideas is at Duke, Doug Boyer and Arianna Harrington. During a visit to Duke a couple years ago, we started talking about this and wondered whether this same method might be used to approach this question of developmental energetics in the fossil record. And they've been looking at this, you know, so can you use skeletal markers to kind of reconstruct that brain energetics curve that I've shown in modern humans in the fossil record? And so here's one illustration of this. So this is the same data that I've already shown you. This is glucose use per gram of brain from our data that I already reported. And you can see that it rises and then it declines down to the adult level. Well, here is blood perfusion. Okay, so this is the amount of blood flow to the brain divided by the number the grams of brain. So it's the same sort of thing. But you see that it follows a very similar pattern. Why this is so high out here, we don't know. This is something that we have to figure out. Okay, but it looks like blood flow follows a very similar pattern to the glucose data that you get from brain scanning, which is very exciting. Now here are some data that Ariana has calculated based upon published measurements of skeletal samples, and you see that it's identifying the height of the peak and the timing of the peak very well. Things break down out here, and there were very small samples out here. She's actually collecting new data as we speak that might clarify this, but I think this is very exciting because it suggests that this method really can potentially identify this peak and its height. And so if we can do this and refine these measurements, I think it's going to give us a new tool to, you know, infer some really important modern human characteristics in the fossil record. Things like energy-intensive learning, slow and extended growth, this pubertal growth spurt that's late and very pronounced, and the organization of societies around cooperation and food sharing. And that's all. Thanks.